Today is Tuesday, June 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, why are so many African migrants crossing into the U.S. across Mexico's border?
This continues to be something that is awfully concerning for us. These folks have been traveling for some time, between 4 and 6 months, most of them.
Hong Kong is moving forward with a controversial extradition law despite millions taking to the streets in protest. A helicopter crashes on top of a New York City skyscraper. And why France is having trouble finding workers to repair the fire-ravaged Notre Dame. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump is looking to claim victory for reaching an immigration deal with Mexico that puts off his threatened tariffs on all Mexican imports. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president's been touting the deal since Friday, but has been stung by questions about just how much of it is actually new. He says Mexico's agreed to things beyond what was announced Friday, but in a CNBC interview would not say what.
We purposely said we wouldn't mention it for a little while.
Mexico's top diplomat says there's nothing to mention, no secret agreements between the two countries. The president could be talking about the idea of Mexico becoming a safe third country, making it harder for migrants passing through it from other places to claim asylum in the U.S. Mexico, though, has long resisted that idea. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Meanwhile, hundreds of African migrants have been arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border within the past week, attempting unauthorized crossings into Texas. Children account for at least half of these migrants. Raul Ortiz is chief patrol officer for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection for the Del Rio sector, that region. His agents patrol 210 miles along the Rio Grande and have apprehended 35,000 people trying to illegally enter the U.S. And he says of those, 20,000 were either unaccompanied children or families. VOA's Carol Gunsberg spoke with Ortiz about why African migrants are showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border and what happens to them when they arrive.
Yeah, some of the push and pull factors that we've experienced across the southwest border certainly have to do with economic drivers. Certainly in some of the countries out of the continent of Africa have experienced some political dynamics, I think, associated with the Ebola outbreak there. And so we have seen, especially in this sector, a significant increase of folks trying to cross illegally in between the ports of entry here in Eagle Pass and in Del Rio, Texas, which are our two highest trafficked areas in the sector.
Is that typically the case? Are those typically the most highest trafficked areas?
So the areas, yes. And then for us, what we have traditionally seen are folks from Central America. We see an awful lot of individuals from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and then, of course, Mexican nationals that are crossing illegally. But over the last 3 or 4 months, we've seen an increase of folks from the continent of Africa, and they range from Angola, Cameroon, Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Somalia. And so this continues to be something that is awfully concerning for us.
Do you have an idea why the increase is happening now?
So one of the things we do know is that these folks have been traveling for some time, between 4 and 6 months, most of them, and they have traveled to different locations, to Laredo, Texas, some even as far as California, and then for whatever reason, whether it was the cartels or a smuggling organization, have pushed them into our area of responsibility, and so we're starting to encounter them in and around the river country that we are patrolling.
What particular challenges does your agency face when you encounter big groups, or particularly when you're apprehending someone who might speak a language that's less familiar to your agents?
Yeah, so fortunately, some of these folks have been in Mexico, Ecuador, Peru, Brazil, you name it. And so they have picked up a bit of the culture and even some of the language. And so when we encounter them, quite often they speak French or Portuguese, and we are able to get some interpreters in there relatively quick. But certainly from a demographic standpoint, we've been encountering family units quite a bit across the southwest border. In fact, our main numbers came out just a couple of days ago, 132,000 apprehensions for May and along the southwest border. But family units from the African countries is something we weren't familiar with, and so it certainly has exposed us to a different dynamic, and our agents have adjusted well.
I'm just curious, when a person is discovered trying to make an unauthorized border crossing or presents himself or herself to authorities, what happens then? What's the process?
So typically what we try and do is we try and evaluate whether, you know, there are any medical conditions that would warrant us either taking them to a medical facility or getting them some sort of medical help immediately. If that is not the case, we have set up what we call centralized processing centers across the entire southwest border, and we take them into custody, and we start really what it comes down to is a processing or an evaluation to determine what type of immigration proceeding or whether they have a criminal record or whether they have some sort of benefit to some immigration relief here in the United States. Quite often, some of these folks will claim credible fear or a fear of returning to their home country, and that puts them on a path to an immigration hearing before an immigration judge. And so, you know, this is really what we're experiencing across the entire southwest border, and almost all of the nine sectors that represent the Border Patrol have seen a significant increase in FAMA units. And what has happened is, I think the word's gotten out that if you come to the United States with a child, chances are you're going to be set free and set up for an immigration hearing at a later date and time.
All right. That was VOA's Carol Ginsberg speaking with Raul Ortiz with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A former jihadi launches a counter-jihadi magazine. Dangerous levels of antibiotics found in the world's rivers. How the U.S. recruits cyber war soldiers. And at U.S. colleges, a lesson in laughter. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A helicopter crash landed on the roof of a rain-shrouded Midtown New York's Manhattan skyscraper, AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The helicopter landed on top of the AXA Equitable Building near Times Square and Trump Tower. People inside felt it.
It was kind of weird, not like a minor earthquake, not kind of like anything I've ever felt before.
Fire Chief Daniel Nigro says one person was killed.
We were able to put water on the fire quite quickly. Unfortunately, we did find a victim.
And Nigro says the helicopter was not allowed in that area. There are flight restrictions since President Trump took office. This is Mayor Bill de Blasio.
There is no indication at this time that this was an act of terror. And there is no ongoing threat to New York City.
The helicopter was flying in a driving downpour. I'm Ed Donahue.
Hong Kong will go forward with a controversial plan to allow people to be extradited to mainland China to face charges, despite a massive protest Sunday, which saw up to a million people taking to the streets. Still, the city's leader, Carrie Lam, told reporters on Monday that she and her team have not ignored any views expressed on the very important piece of legislation she called, but thought it was important to push forward regardless, adding that the government has made several changes to the bill following public criticism. My colleague Kim Lewis got an update on what's been happening in Hong Kong with VOA Cantonese service reporter Raymond Yam.
You probably see it has come down because the government already cleared the there were demonstrators try to stay overnight outside the Legislative Council, or you call it LegCo, in Hong Kong. But however, there will be the legislative session on this coming Wednesday in the morning. It will be the second reading according to the schedule for this bill. And the organizer already calling for more people participate and surrounding the LegCo building on Wednesday to for their protests. But I'm not sure how big it will be. As you may know, nobody predicted that it will be more than a million yesterday participating in Hong Kong.
What is the real fear behind this proposed extradition law?
As you may know, Hong Kong has followed the British rule and still following the British judicial system or copy it. China is a totally a different scenario. China is not just for the different legal system, but people are quite skeptical about how fair for the trial is. As you may hear, that the government official always said that the court or everything in China is serving the Communist Party for their main purpose. So people are worried about, are there any fair trial or independent trial? And also, you may also hear there were lots of disputes related with the businessmen in China, no matter where you come from. And people are worried that if there is bogus charges against them, there will be no way for them to defend themselves. At the same time, when the bogus charges send it to Hong Kong, the Hong Kong court or the law authority in Hong Kong, they only check the evidence or the so-called evidence come from China, and there's no other rights or the other decision that the Hong Kong court can do the judgment to decide is this evidence fake or this is genuine evidence against this person, so that this person will be eligible extradite to mainland China. And this is what people worry, that for bogus charges they might be indicted or they might be extradited to mainland China without any appeal structure or the system.
Now, also, Carrie Lam, she has vowed to go ahead and push ahead with this bill despite all of the protests. And as you mentioned, this was the largest demonstration seen there in years. So what is her position, and really, do you think she will be forced to resign?
This is a very tricky question. And of course, when Carrie Lam elected 2 years ago, at the speech she claimed that if the majority of the people in Hong Kong believe that she's no longer eligible or she's no longer handled the situation in Hong Kong, she will resign. However, in this scenario, we see Carrie Lam was standing very firm, and seems like she got a blessing from Beijing in order to persuade this law, try to pass it in the LegCo. So this is a lot of uncertainty. It may or may not repeat the same scenario that the first chief executive, Mr. Tung Chee Hwa, resigned because of the pressure of the people. But in this scenario, as you may also see, the recent situation in China, the Chinese President Xi Jinping is very active, very aggressive in no matter domestic or the international issues. So Carrie Lam probably got the blessing or maybe backup from Beijing, and she probably can hang out for a little bit while. I would say that's uncertain.
Also, what can we expect to see just in the few days ahead?
You definitely will see there will be another demonstration outside the Legislative Council building on Wednesday. How does it turn out? Will it turn out green? Nobody knows. It could be or it could be not. There's a lot of uncertainties around here, so it's difficult to say.
All right, that's VOA Cantonese Service reporter Raymond Yam speaking with Kim Lewis. Well, it's been just about 2 months now since a tragic fire ravaged the iconic Notre Dame Cathedral in France. Officials there have been working to try to be able to at least open up the courtyard within the next week to set up some sort of altar for people to come and worship. And across France, there is a strong push and desire to rebuild and make the iconic structure whole again. But apparently the country is running into some problems with finding workers who are able to replicate some of the medieval work. Joining us from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, why so much trouble finding people?
Over the years, with mechanicalization and with the advent of more computer-based technology, some of the actual workmen, some of these traditional trades, if you like, the techniques that are going to be needed for the reconstruction, they just don't have the manpower. And in particular, the government is already saying that there just are not enough stonemasons, not enough blacksmiths, who will be able to do the work that is needed. And this is, you know, in lots of ways, it's been a problem that's always been there for France, that they do not have these, you know, these traditional tradesmen. But it's come to the fore, and the government's had to really go back and try and find a way of introducing, if you like, a whole new system for apprenticeships, for training youngsters, and also to giving a sort of a value to these types of jobs that had been seen as, if you like, something that was very old school and not really the way ahead for the new younger generation.
So what's the plan?
Well, the plan is, at the moment, is to have a look around, see what other projects there are in place that the government can, if you like, get tips from. And that's why the government had their attention drawn to a project about 100 miles to the south of Paris in Burgundy, where there's been a group of people for the last few years have been reconstructing a 13th century Gothic castle. And down there, they have actually been using these types of old techniques of using blacksmiths, woodcutters, quarrymen to build this old chateau. It's only horsepower they're using. There's no electric tools. So the government's been forced today, to go down there, have a look, see what level of technology that these workmen are using, to see these really what are what many would consider the ancient building techniques. But these ancient building techniques are what's going to be needed if they're going to get Notre-Dame de Paris, put back together in a way that we'll have everyone thinking that she's part of Paris again.
So I guess at this point they're not really making any kind of commitment or promise as to when Notre Dame will be back together and whole again, where people could actually come and worship.
No, there's no idea. If you talk to architects, they're saying 10 years possibly, if they're lucky. If you speak to the French President Emmanuel Macron, he says 5 years. It's got to be done in 5 years, he says. It's got to be finished in time for the 2024 Olympics that are going to be held in Paris. He has said quite clearly that France is a nation of builders and it can build structures quite easily. But there's a long process that has to be gone through. One of them is this architectural competition that's now in place that called for architects to come up with ideas as to how the new roof of the Notre Dame will look. Some people say it should be a green roof and it should be open to all people so they can go up there and they can walk around, have a view over Paris from there. Others have said that it should just be the old roof put back, you just do it as it was before. So it's going to take at least a year before all those are in, and then it's going to go full parliament. But I think we're looking at closer to the 10 years if you talk to people on the ground than the 5 years President Macron would like. One of the other more immediate problems for Notre Dame is there is a lot of decontamination work still to be undertaken, and that means particularly for the lead poisoning, which they have great fears that it's worse than at first thought. They have asked young children and women who are pregnant who live nearby Notre Dame to go to hospitals, get checked to see if the lead levels have gone down. Of course, there was a lot of lead in the building, particularly in the roof. It's got lead pipes. And these, when they melted in the enormous heat, the particles went into the air and it is spreading in that area. So what they are hoping is that the decontamination work that has been undertaken is sort of coming to an end, and the big hope is that sometime within the next week they might be able to open up the courtyard in front of Notre Dame and to be able to set up an altar there, so that at some stage in the near future they will be able to hold, if not full masses there, then they will at least be able to say Vespers of an evening. And given that it's coming into the summer months here in Paris, that would be something at least that people could go along to and would be able to attend Vespers.
All right, that's Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi-Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices. voices.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. In Los Angeles, California this week, gaming fans are attending the Electronic Entertainment Expo, an annual video game trade show also known as E3. The video game industry had $43.4 billion in sales in 2018. Joining us from the expo to talk more about what is happening is technology reporter Chris Morris. So, Chris, you go to this event every year, and I know Microsoft is a big deal there. Do they have anything new that they're talking about, any new consoles?
You know, Microsoft had 60 games on display at their press conference this year, so which is a pretty impressive number. But I think the big takeaway from that was their talk about their next-generation console, the next Xbox. That's codenamed Project Scarlet right now. It's going to come out next year, probably around November or so. And they're going to launch it with a new Halo title, which they did the original Xbox They're going to come out with a new Halo title, which they did with the original Xbox way back when. And the important thing about that is that Halo is a system seller. And so as they come out with this new console, it really gives them a chance to get back on top of the console market.
Have they slipped quite a bit?
Well, Sony has taken a really big lead this console generation. The PlayStation 4 has greatly outsold the Xbox One, both domestically and internationally. So Microsoft is looking to go back on top of that, or at least become a little closer to Sony as those two companies kind of continue their WWE theatrics of who's winning or losing the console wars.
So are there any new competitors coming into the market?
Well, you know, it's always been PlayStation and Xbox and Nintendo for decades now, but we're finally getting to a point in the industry where you are seeing new companies become interested. Google is starting a new service this fall called Stadia, and what that is it's a game streaming service.
I've been hearing about game streaming. What exactly is that?
Well, game streaming is sort of like what you have with Netflix these days. You're able to just call up a movie on demand on Netflix, and it starts almost instantly. Imagine that with a video game. So instead of having to download a 2 or 3 gigabit file, which takes, you know, anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour or so, depending on your internet connection, you're able to immediately start playing on your TV, or you're able to start playing on your laptop or a tablet or your phone. You can pull this from anywhere. And it's a new way of delivering games. It's been sort of teased for a number of years, but the technology is finally there. So Google's doing that. PlayStation has its own service. Microsoft is about to launch one called xCloud. It's really sort of the future of where video game delivery is going.
Fascinating. So how are the crowds this year?
It's a crowded year. This is an odd E3 because there aren't any new consoles. It's sort of the end of this generation. So there are some big absences at the show. Xbox has something separate outside of the show floor. Sony is not here at all. But that's not stopping fans from showing up and showing their devotion to this industry.
All right, that is technology reporter Chris Morris coming to us from the E3 Expo in Los Angeles, California. American country music singer Darius Rucker has raised a total of $2 million over the past 10 years for St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Nashville, Tennessee. This milestone came after his 10th annual benefit concert, Darius and Friends, this past week, which raised $425,000. On his website, Rucker says he was struck on his very first visit by how St. Jude cares about its patients and families.
Can't know me. Yeah,
Maybe I'm a wild one. Don't let me run, let me get away. Yeah, maybe I'm a wild.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
I'm attracted to your physical, but I got this lazy eye that likes to wonder. If you throw this dog a bone, maybe you and I can make a house a home. Yeah, yeah, baby, I'm a wild one. Don't let me run, don't let me get away. Yeah, baby, I'm a wild one. Yeah, baby, I'm a wild one. Don't let me run, don't let me get away. Yeah, baby, I'm a wild one.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Promoting greater respect for human rights remains a key component of U.S. foreign policy, including in its relations with Vietnam. At a recent meeting of the U.S.-Vietnam Human Rights Dialogue, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Scott Busby expressed concern over the increasing number of political prisoners in Vietnam, which he estimated to be over 100. Mr. Busby described his visit with one such prisoner.
While I was in Vietnam, I made a visit to one political prisoner of particular concern, namely Chun Thi Nha, who is imprisoned in the middle of the country. She received a 9-year-long sentence merely for exercising her freedom of speech. She served 2 years of that sentence already, but faces another 7 years.
Internet freedom is also under assault in Vietnam, reports Deputy Assistant Secretary Busby. Vietnam, he said, recently adopted a cybersecurity law that we have a number of concerns about. We, as the Human Rights Bureau, of course, are concerned about the restrictions this law poses on exercise of freedom of speech. Bloggers are being arrested in ever larger numbers. The U.S. raised with Vietnam the case of blogger and contributor to Radio Free Asia, Chung Zui Nhat, said Mr. Busby.
He was recently in Thailand, applied for refugee status in Thailand with UNHCR, and then mysteriously disappeared from Thailand and suddenly reappeared in a jail in Vietnam. We're very concerned about his case, about the circumstances surrounding his abduction in Thailand and his transfer to Vietnam. He has not yet been charged or prosecuted, but we're very concerned about the way the government is treating his case.
With regard to religious freedom, the Vietnamese government's record is mixed, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Busby.
We continue to have concern that unregistered religious groups in Vietnam are being harassed, are not able to freely practice their religion. That said, those groups that have been willing to register under Vietnam's religious freedom law have enjoyed a greater degree of freedom to practice their religions than they have in the past.
The U.S. continues to call on the Vietnamese government to release all prisoners of conscience and allow all Vietnamese citizens to express their political views without fear of retribution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is the